This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. E.J. Dionne predicts that America is about to enter a new progressive era of civic activism and government reform. As Dionne sees it, the powerful heyday of the religious right is over, but, he says, conservative Christians can remain politically viable if they adapt and take on issues other than opposition to abortion and gay marriage. Dionne presents that argument in his new book, Sold Out, Reclaiming Faith and Politics After the Religious Right. He spoke about his ideas during a mid-March speech to the Commonwealth Club of California, and it's that speech we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. In addition to writing his syndicated column for The Washington Post, E.J. Dionne is a regular political analyst on National Public Radio, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and a professor at Georgetown University. And here he is, speaking March 13th at the Commonwealth Club of California about his new book, Sold Out.
This is one of the only books you'll ever read about religion that begins with a joke, at least the only book about religion that's actually sympathetic to religion that begins with a joke. It's one of my favorite jokes, and I promised, I've told it so often, many of my friends have heard me tell it many times, and I promised them that I would stop telling the joke after I used it at the beginning of my book, but the spirit is willing and the flesh is weak. And besides, I've always thought that this story was a really good reminder of how and why the words Jesus and religious were not always and reflexively associated with the words right or conservative. It's the story of Mrs. O'Reilly, who was being taken to the polls by her son on Election Day. And Mrs. O'Reilly had always voted straight Democratic, and her son had gotten rather wealthy. He was registered as an independent. In fact, he voted for a lot of Republicans, but he still, good son that he was, took his mother to vote. And one election day, as always, he asked her, how are you going to vote? And as always, she said, straight Democratic. And one of these times, the exasperated son looked at her and said, you know, Mom, if Jesus came back to earth and ran as a Republican, you would vote against him. And Mrs. O'Reilly snapped back and said, oh, hush, why should he change his party after all these years? And I think we've been having a lot of discussions about religion and politics because a great many Americans have come to believe that he changed his party after all these years. On significant parts of the right and the left, there is a sense that religion always has been and always will be a conservative force. There were Republican candidates and political operatives who assume that religious people live on the right, care primarily about issues such as gay marriage and abortion, and will forever be part of the GOP's political base. There were liberals, so I think fewer than conservatives think, who buy this Republican account and write off religious people as backward, reactionary busybodies obsessed with sex. Sold Out rejects this view. It insists that religious faith does not ineluctably lead to conservative convictions. It argues, as I said, that the era of the religious right is over and that its collapse is part of a larger decline in a certain style of ideological conservatism that reached high points in 1980 and 1994 and perhaps 2002, but suffered a series of decisive and, I believe, fatal setbacks in the final years of President Bush's second term. The end of the religious right does not signal a decline in evangelical Christianity. On the contrary, it is a sign, if a Catholic can use this term, of a new reformation among Christians who are disentangling their great movement from a political machine. This historic change will require liberals and conservatives alike to abandon their narrow views of who religious Americans are and what they believe. At the heart of my argument is the view that religious faith, far from being inevitably on the side of the status quo, should on principle call this world to higher standards. Religious people should always be wary of the ways in which political power is wielded and skeptical of how economic privileges are distributed. They should also be wary of how their own traditions have been used for narrow political purposes and how some religious figures have manipulated faith to aggrandize their own power. Of the doctrine of original sin, the idea of a fallen side of human nature, these apply in principle to people who are religious no less than to those who are not. Throughout history, in fact, our great religious traditions, and this is especially obvious in the Christian and Jewish scriptures, have preached a message of hope for more just and decent human arrangements. Now, one of my favorite teachers, the theologian Harvey Cox, argued many years ago that the theological enterprise seeks to grasp the problem man faces in this historic present in the light of the past and the future, that is, in light of faith and hope. Cox was right to call on religious institutions to speak with pointed specificity to their age and shape their message and mission not for their own comfort, but for the health and renewal of the world. Now, one of the things I always like to point out is that I have been interested in this subject my whole life, and that this book reflects a kind of personal journey. I grew up, as some of you may have, in one of those households that broke that most basic rule. We always talked about politics and religion at the dinner table. And it has always seemed to me that it was peculiar to expect religion to be separate from politics. Historically, that is not the case. And that one of the arguments I make, and I'd love to talk about in the question and answer period, is it is quite different to insist upon the separation of church and state so that no particular religion dominates government and so that religions are free from the interference of government. It is quite another to talk about the separation of religion and politics. But it is also important to look to how we use religion and politics, and how we react to our scriptures, whether we ransack them simply for support of whatever political views we have before we open the book. I once debated Ralph Reed of the Christian Coalition, and I said to Ralph, I will always defend your right to base your political conclusions on your religious beliefs, but you do have to explain to me where you see in the New Testament Jesus calling for a cut in the capital gains tax. I simply cannot find it in mine. The title of my book can be read in two ways. It speaks to our country's exhaustion with a religious style in politics that was excessively dogmatic, partisan, and ideological. It is a style reflecting a spirit far too certain of itself and far too insistent on the depravity of its political adversaries. Linking religion too closely to the fortunes of one political party or one leader or a group of leaders is always a mistake. It encourages alienation from faith itself. Where, after all, did Voltaire come from? Where did the new atheist writers come from? By turning a concern with the ultimate into a prop for temporal power. It distorts great traditions to require them to bob and weave in order to accommodate the political needs of a given moment or the immediate requirements of a given politician. A great many people, including a great many religious people, have had enough of this. And they've had enough of this in the other sense, for the reason embodied in the other sense of the title. Reducing religion to politics or to a narrow set of public issues amounts to a great sellout of our religious traditions. It is common to speak of religion as selling out to secularism or to modernity or to a fashionable relativism. But there is a more immediate danger, I think, particularly after the last 15 or 20 years, of religion selling out to political forces that use the votes of religious people for reasons having nothing to do with a religious agenda and often enough for causes that may contradict the values such voters prize most. As I say, it is a great sellout of religion to insist that it has much to teach us about abortion or gay marriage, but little useful to say about social justice, war and peace, the organization of our work lives, the death penalty, immigration, or our approach to providing for the old, the sick, and the desperate. Religion becomes less relevant to public life when its role is marginalized to a predetermined list of values issues. I remember, some of you may remember, in 2004, when the exit pollsters asked people why they voted as they did. And they listed moral values and then Iraq, education, the economy, and other issues. Now, I always ask audiences, is there anyone in the room who in 2004 cast his or her vote on the basis of immoral values? I have yet to meet a person willing to say that, though if I ever did, I'd want to take them out for a drink after a session of this sort. But think about the way that question was posed. If you cared passionately about Iraq, whether you believed in the war or thought it was a terrible mistake, you might have a strong moral view of that, but that doesn't count as a moral value. If you cared about whether our economy was fair and just and checked the little box that said the economy, that didn't count as a moral value. If you cared about the education of our children and checked that box, that didn't count as a moral value. It is a very peculiar way to look at the word moral and to look at the word value. And I think that is one of the things that people have had enough of. And I don't think the problem with that question was just that the pollsters didn't know how to write the question. They were also reflecting something that was going on in politics. The idea that the religious winds are changing is sold out's central theme. Now, when I argue that the era of the religious right is over, there are many people who say that's wishful thinking on your part. That's what a lot of liberals want to think. That's not really true. I'd like to suggest to you that there are several very large chunks of evidence in support of this idea. The first piece is simply from the 2008 Republican primaries themselves. You will notice that John McCain, who won the Republican nomination, was a candidate who had absolutely no support from the old organizations of the religious right. He won the Republican nomination despite his lack of support in these groups. Mike Huckabee, himself an evangelical, someone whom I believe has one foot in the old religious right and one foot in the new thing that is happening that I'm going to talk about a bit before I close. He won a huge evangelical vote, also despite having no support from the organized leaders. He got support from some of the newer groups like the homeschoolers, but none of the established leaders went with him. They tended to go with Mitt Romney or Fred Thompson. Pat Robertson supported Rudy Giuliani and apparently performed no miracles for him. And so you're already seeing these established leaders sort of not having influence even in the party that they were a part of. Secondly, you're seeing many new leaders emerge within the, or what you might call the theologically conservative religious community. Someone I write about a fair amount in the book is Rick Warren, whom some of you may know. All authors who talk about Rick Warren are in their hearts committing the sin of covetousness, because his book, The Purpose-Driven Life, has sold something like 25 or 30 million copies, which I am quite sure I will not do with this little book of mine. But Rick Warren, he is himself a very traditional evangelical. He is opposed to abortion. He is opposed to gay marriage. But he has very pointedly said that Jesus' agenda is not about one or two issues. He has said that poverty is an issue that must be of central concern to Christians. Encouraged by his wife, he has organized a major mission to Africa to help the victims of AIDS. Last year, the year before last, he invited two speakers to his Saddleback Valley Community Church who had been very active in the fight help folks in Africa with AIDS. One was Senator Sam Brownback, a conservative Republican who had done a great deal. The other was Senator Barack Obama, whom I don't need to introduce to you. And Rick Warren got a lot of grief for inviting Barack Obama by opponents of abortion and others who didn't want this liberal in his church. And Rick Warren said something that I have treasured ever since I ran across it. He said, I am not for the right wing or for the left wing. I am for the whole bird. And I think what you're seeing is the emergence of a great deal of whole bird Christianity out there. Another person I write about in the book is Rich Cizik, who's head of the National Association of Evangelicals. His reading of the scriptures told him that we have a responsibility for the stewardship of the earth. That means we have a responsibility to the environment. That meant to Rich Cizik that evangelicals should have a special commitment to ending global warming. Again, he came under attack from the more political, conservative political evangelicals. This shouldn't be our agenda. You're broadening the agenda too much. And the board of the National Association of Evangelicals, not exactly as liberal as the ACLU, voted nearly unanimously to support Rick and this idea that evangelicals should be committed to action on the environment. So the religious winds are changing.
Columnist, NPR commentator, and author E.J. Dionne speaking March 13th at the Commonwealth Club of California. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
If my book is an argument with some of my conservative friends, whom I believe have narrowed the religious agenda, it is also an argument with liberals, and I consider myself proudly a liberal. Indeed, the more the word comes under attack, the more I want to embrace it. That's not just because I'm contrarian, but if you're not willing to defend a word, then how can you be counted on to defend anything else? I think it's very important, not because of what the exit poll showed in 2004, but as a matter of principle, that liberals not harbor prejudices against people of faith. Liberals are very proud of the fact that they have opposed racism and anti-Semitism and discrimination against gays and lesbians, and they're right to be proud about those things. Well, they should not then turn around and harbor prejudices against people of faith. Not only that, liberals in the United States need to realize how important our religious traditions and our churches and synagogues have been to the development of liberalism. William Jennings Bryan is a figure I have become more and more fascinated by. There's a great biography of him by Mike Kazin, by the way, for those of you who are interested, that came out recently. And he is best remembered by us today because of the great movie for his passionate opposition to Darwin and evolution. But as Mike Kazin wrote, it was Bryan who transformed the Democratic Party from a bulwark of conservatism into a bastion of anti-corporate progressivism. Bryan preached, as Mike wrote, a simple pragmatic gospel. Only mobilized citizens imbued with Christian morality could save the nation from predatory interests and the individuals who did their bidding. Bryan, as Gary Wills has noted, could point with pride to the success of the many causes he championed in their earlier stages. This is a pretty good record for a progressive. Women's suffrage, the federal income tax, railroad regulation, currency reform, initiative and referendum, creating a Department of Labor, campaign finance reform, and opposition to capital punishment. Bryan's progressivism was not eccentric among believers. The social gospel arose in the early 20th century from the reflections of religious social workers and activists confronting the contradictions between the promises of God's kingdom and the conditions in the slums. Advocates of the social gospel were among those, and think of this, this is Teddy Roosevelt beginning the Progressive Party, splitting off from the Republicans, and this is how he ended his acceptance speech. He said, "We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord, and the Lord in this instance was presumed to be a progressive." And we could go through a long historical list. The abolitionist movement was in many ways the creation of the new evangelical movement. My friend Jim Wallace has noted that the altar call, which has become very familiar in evangelical churches, was actually invented at anti-slavery meetings where people were called forward to declare their commitment to the movement against slavery. And then, of course, you had the civil rights movement, led by a preacher who preached from the scriptures and from the Declaration of Independence. And in the case of my own church, the Catholic bishop's 1919 program of social reconstruction could be seen in many ways as calling us toward what became the New Deal. I want to end on two themes. One I like to bring up because it surprises people. It seems to me that one of the greatest gifts of religion to public life is not when it promotes certainty, but when it encourages reflection, self-criticism, and doubt. Now, to assert that encouraging doubt is one of faith's major purposes may seem paradoxical, but in fact, the Christian and Jewish traditions, with which I am most familiar, always call us to a form of moral doubt, which, as the political theorist Bill Galston has argued, questions our motivations and our pretensions to special virtue. What kind of doubt am I talking about? In an assertion that might have usefully guided us before our country went to war in Iraq, Reinhold Niebuhr warned, "A nation with an inordinate degree of political power is doubly tempted to exceed the bounds of historical possibilities if it is informed by an idealism which does not understand the limits of man's wisdom and volition." The greatest expression of the kind of humility that I am thinking of, I think, is Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address. Many of you are familiar with that second inaugural address. I covered it as a journalist. Now, think of this. Lincoln was speaking after 4 years of civil war. If anyone could claim to have been on the right side of history, leading a civil war that became a struggle against slavery, it was Abraham Lincoln. If anyone could have claimed that he was on God's side, I think Abraham Lincoln had a fair case for that. But that's not what Abraham Lincoln did. Just to listen to this brief passage. He said of the North and South, both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces, but let us judge not, lest we not be judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. Now, imagine that. Even in this extreme instance, Lincoln refused to assume an absolute identification between his own cause and God's will. David Price, a Democratic member of Congress from North Carolina, argues that Lincoln expresses the moral commitment against slavery in uncompromising terms. And he is determined in that speech to finish the job we're in, but he refuses to go farther than that in claiming God's sanction. I think he demonstrated as clearly as any statesman that it is possible to undertake great tasks in politics with firmness, commitment, principle, and courage, and still not pretend to absolute certainty of one's course, one's intentions, or the purity of one's motives. I want to close By talking about something which many people will like and a few people will dissent from. I want to talk about one of my favorite movies. And that movie is It's a Wonderful Life, the story of George Bailey, played by Jimmy Stewart. I believe that many people think this is simply a schmaltzy Christmas movie. I believe it tells us, tells politicians, tells religious leaders, almost everything they need to know about how Americans think and feel about moral values. And watching it is a lot cheaper than paying for a focus group. Now, I probably do not have to describe It's a Wonderful Life in too much detail, but, you know, it's worth noting that George Bailey, played by Jimmy Stewart, married to Donna Reed, has a bunch of kids. He runs a local SNL, and he lends money to the town's working people so they can get their own tidy homes. In doing so, he faces the town's evil big banker, Mr. Potter, who doesn't care a whit about working stiffs. At the end of the movie, George is close to killing himself because his absent-minded uncle loses his deposit. Enter George's guardian angel, who shows George how much poorer the world would have been without him. George is convinced his life is wonderful. Call me a sap. I always get a tear in my eye at that closing scene in that Christmas celebration when all of his neighbors have gathered to help him out of his jam. Now, why is this 1947 movie still so popular? It is easy to dismiss It's a Wonderful Life as a nostalgic celebration of small-town living, a flight from complexity, from racial, ethnic, and religious diversity, from changing gender roles. A feminist friend has told me on some occasions that It's a Wonderful Life has a gender problem, and perhaps it does, and from the achievement of 21st-century capitalism. Now, there's probably something to each of these critiques, but I think it misses what gives this film power. It's because Frank Capra, who made it, understood certain commitments that run deep in the American character. So think of the following as a four-point focus group report. Focus group point number one, Americans are deeply egalitarian, but they believe in upward mobility and the value of owning property. Mr. Potter is a cad because he doesn't believe in the town's ordinary people and doesn't think they're worthy of respect. George respects them enough to help them become property owners. Focus group point number two, capitalists can be good, but only if they recognize moral limits. There is a social mortgage on their wealth. Americans believe in capitalism, but of a certain kind. Americans oppose, as Chuck Collins and Mary Wright have written, the stifling of individual initiative and enterprise, but they also mistrust capitalism unless it is balanced with the common good and concerns for justice. George Bailey is a capitalist who understands both halves of this commitment. Mr. Potter is loath because all he cares about is cash. Focus group point number three. These commitments to egalitarianism, upward mobility, broadly shared property ownership, capitalism within moral limits are important because they underwrite a set of values. For those of you who remember the movie, remember that when Clarence shows George what life would have been like without him, he shows him a Bedford Falls renamed Pottersville that has been turned into a honky-tonk gambling town. Rackets, drunkenness, prostitution, and meanness have replaced the warmth of a real community. By showing life with and without George Bailey, Capra shows us two alternative social systems and makes clear which one works. If you believe in good values, if you believe in family values, you must believe in social justice. And lastly, Americans do love family values, but they dislike harsh condemnations of those who may fail in their efforts to live up with them. Remember in this movie, George Bailey, the model of the loving family man, risks scandal by lending money to an old friend who has become, in the parlance of the time, a bad girl. The movie celebrates George's behavior and paints the blue-nosed scandal mongers as cheap and tawdry. At its heart, this movie points to a past that lives on. It puts forward a balanced set of commitments that still inspire most Americans. It is a classic attempt to describe a better world, and it is shows us a path to ending the cultural and religious wars that we have been living through these last 20 years. I believe that we need passion and we need humility. These two virtues do not often come together, but they must. We need a passion for moving our nation out of a period in which public problems went unsolved and the possibilities of broad alliances were lost because narrow political imperatives triumphed over the idea of the common good. We need humility to understand how prejudices of believers against unbelievers and unbelievers against believers have obstructed our path and blurred our vision. Self-righteousness is the enemy of righteousness, and hope is the virtue on which faith and love depend. Thank you all very much.
E.J. Dionne is a syndicated columnist, a self-described liberal, and author of the new book, Sold Out: Reclaiming Faith and Politics After the Religious Right. He spoke at the Commonwealth Club of California on March 13th, and you're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After E.J. Dionne's speech, he took questions from the audience and moderator Phil Bronstein, editor-at-large of the San Francisco Chronicle.
Do you see the day when an avowed atheist might have other than a snowball's chance in hell of becoming president?
That's a great question. I do, someday. I think it would be a very, very difficult, it would be very difficult right now. I work with an organization called the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, and we did a poll a few years ago, and it produced one of my favorite results. The same people were asked, basically, do you want a religious person as president? 70% said yes. And then there was another kind of agree-disagree question. I don't like it when politicians say how religious they are. 50% said yes to that. That meant that many of the people who wanted a religious president didn't want the candidate to talk about, give them information that would make them know how religious he or she is. And I think that for a lot of people, religious becomes a surrogate for morality. And I think there's a general view that someone who is religious may be somewhat more moral than someone else. I am personally not of the view that you have to be religious to be moral. But I think there is this sense in the public. But yet people are uneasy with too much religion in public, which is reflected in that 50% answer. And so I think it will happen someday. One of the fastest growing religious groups in the United States are the unaffiliated, the people who are either atheists, agnostics, or don't belong to a faith. A recent study by Pew found that that group is about 16, somewhere between 16 and 17% of the country. And now I don't think we are going to ever to become as a country as secular as Europe has become. That is, by the way, partly because of our First Amendment and our long history of not having an established church, which has been very good for religion in our country. So, yes, I think it'll happen someday. But it will not happen in this election, since all the obvious candidates all claim rather strongly to believe in God.
I actually believe in the breadth of possibility. So let me ask this question: would President Bush agree with your thesis of the book?
I don't think so. I think he would agree. I mean, what would he agree with? In the book, I talk quite a bit about Bush. I'm, you know, in my column, for those of you who may read it occasionally, I'm rather a critic of President Bush's. The one thing I have, one of the handful of things I've defended him on is certain ways in which he's used religious language in public. I have a long section in the book where I quote the president quoting St. Paul, "We are all part of one another, and we must sort of, we must stand with one another." And it's a very long religious passage that has some compassion in it. And then I ask my readers a question: can you not stand it when your president talks this way? And the whole passage is from Bill Clinton at the Metropolitan Baptist Church in Washington in 1987. I think a lot of what Bush... a lot of Bush's religious language is more typically presidential than given credit for, than people realize. Where my critical moments about Bush are, and I won't keep you the rest of the time, but the critical moments are, his compassionate conservatism, where he put forward the faith-based initiative, but really didn't put a lot of money behind it when the choice was to spend money on tax cuts or spend money on programs for the poor, including the faith-based initiative. The money went to the tax cuts. And I think there is, the core argument of the book is very critical of a form of conservative politics which uses certain issues like abortion and gay marriage to elect politicians who then spend most of their time on an economically conservative agenda, which many rank and file evangelicals, particularly those of moderate incomes, neither benefit from nor are wild about. And then, of course, this particular foreign policy, which has created problems of its own. So I suspect the president might appreciate those passages saying, no, he's not. Some of these criticisms of the way he talks are unfair, but then he'll disagree with a number of the other things I say in the book.
Now, with the lessening of religion and politics, does that mean we're going to miss out on all those great weeping confessions and public resurrections of political and religious figures?
No, I think weeping in politics will always happen when it's in the interest of the weeper. I don't think that is going away. I mean, one of the other reasons I believe we are in this period of change is that we've been here before. When you look historically, it took people by surprise when the religious right gained traction in 1980. Why did it take them by surprise? We had gone through a very long, relatively secular era in politics. Again, our president spoke a lot about religion. President Roosevelt once said there's not room enough, there's not enough living room, Lebensraum, Hitler's term, for God and Hitler. There was a lot of religious language used, but we didn't have these cultural fights from about 1932 to 1980. But we forget that if you want culture wars, go back to the 1928 election, another event I covered. There were two big issues in that election. One was whether we should elect the first Catholic president, Al Smith, and the other was whether we should continue prohibition. Catholics lost, prohibition won, and then something happened about a year after that election. It was the crash on Wall Street, October 29th, 1929. All of a sudden, the question of whether people could drink booze or not really didn't seem quite so important when the unemployment rate rose 5, 10, 15, 20 percent. And that's where this long, less sort of culture war, religious war period began. I think we will date the period we've just come out of, 1980 to 2008, because I believe we are now in a situation where many, many Americans, including very religious Americans, are saying we have a number of very large public problems to solve with the economy, in Iraq, with our standing in the world generally. And you saw evidence of this in the 2006 election. And so I think there's a kind of historical logic that points us to a different kind of period. It won't be the same as the period 1932 to 1980. There will still be a lot of religious dialogue and politics. And one other thing, which is Obama and Clinton are quite a bit like Roosevelt in the sense that he wanted to heal those culture wars and in from the 20s. Obama and Clinton are speaking in very welcoming ways to people of faith, I think partly by way of ending this religious war period and moving on to a different period.
Please comment about Mitt Romney being a Mormon. Did it hurt Romney in his race to the Republican nomination?
Yeah, I'm afraid that it did. Mitt Romney's politics are not my politics, but I actually wrote a column sort of late last year arguing against anti-Mormon prejudice. And, you know, I'm a Catholic. We are in a religious minority. We got discriminated against. Jews got discriminated against. I think, you know, at certain times in our history, Baptists got discriminated against. I think any of us, each of us has an obligation to stand up for some other religious minority that's under attack. And so I think there was a certain reaction, particularly, although I don't think exclusively, among some evangelical Christians against Romney's Mormonism. And, you know, we can have our own views of Mormonism, but it troubles me that whenever that kind of prejudice enters politics. And I wish the media exit polls had included a question on this in at least one of them, because I'd love to know, you know, how big a factor this was. But I certainly think there was some prejudice out there.
Do you think that Jews, Buddhists, Muslims, et cetera, have influence with politicians in the way that similar to Christians?
You know, whenever I hear that list, some of you may know a great book written in the 50s about American religion called Catholic, Protestant, Jew. Imagine what the title of that book would have to be now: Catholic, Protestant, Jew, Muslim, Jain, Confucian, Hindu. We could go on and on because of the religious diversity that's grown in a rather short period of time. The answer is, you know, I think that groups that have been here a long time, Catholics, Protestants, Jews, have considerable religious influence. I think the other groups, as they increase their numbers, will have more influence. You're seeing, for example, in some communities where the Muslim community has gotten larger, has more influence in those communities. I think it's largely a question of size and organization. And I think the communities that came here earlier are bigger and better organized, but I think the other groups, if we follow our pattern, our historical pattern, will gain influence as their numbers grow.
Organization's often a bigger deal than size, actually, isn't it?
At times. They're both important. Right. I mean, if you got a lot of votes, people are going to pay attention to you, no matter how poorly organized you are.
Do you believe the churches should be taxed?
No. I think that there's a whole role for the not-for-profit sector. There are ways. I think you need to keep an eye on people not abusing their status, and that's true of other nonprofits, but it's probably particularly true of churches. But no, I think it's a benefit to society. I do worry about communities that have large numbers of not-for-profit, cities that depend on property taxes, that have a lot of nonprofit organizations owning property. This applies to universities. There often has to be some recompense for that. But no, I wouldn't tax churches.
E.J. Dionne, author of Sold Out, Reclaiming Faith and Politics After the Religious Right. He spoke March 13th at the Commonwealth Club of California. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. Now, back to E.J. Dionne and moderator Phil Bronstein.
What political leaders, authors, and organizations can you name that are seeking to break down the red-blue divide, say, on issues like abortion, gay marriage, and stem cell research?
That's a good question. Let me just take abortion as the example. It's one of the arguments in my book is that we've had the same basic abortion debate since Roe v. Wade, and no one's really happy with it. The pro-life side points to the fact that we've got a million abortions a year or more. The pro-choice side sort of lives in worry that this right will eventually disappear. I don't think anyone on the pro-life side, I think very few people on the pro-life side actually believe that we will eventually ban abortion all across the country. I think if Roe v. Wade falls, we will not ban abortion in most of the country. And so what I argue for in the book is why don't we, instead of having this argument over criminalizing or banning abortion, why don't we try to reduce the number of abortions in America? We can agree that our abortion rate is much higher than in most developed countries where abortion is illegal. There shouldn't be that many abortions in the United States. How do you reduce it? Well, on the prevention side, with contraception, with all other efforts to prevent unintended pregnancies, programs that combine abstinence and contraception in sex education courses. And on the other side, let's help poor women who want to choose life and bring their children into the world. A poor woman who knows that she will be able to support her child, will have health insurance, is more likely to choose life than a woman who does not have that support. The abortion rate dropped about 11% in the 90s. We could agree to bring down the number of abortions. So there's a bill to that effect, has a lot of sponsors in the House. The two leaders are Rosa DeLauro, who is pro-choice, Tim Ryan, who is pro-life. I think there are efforts of that sort that could move us out of the culture war.
Is the focus, this is sort of a culture war kind of story, is the focus of the right on sexual morality a conscious effort to turn moral focus away from traditional Christian teachings regarding peace and the poor?
That's a great question, and I think that for some people it is a conscious strategy. For others, it comes from their own theological understanding. I think that there's been a great argument, a serious argument over should we put the emphasis on individual sin or should we put the emphasis on social sin. It seems to me that's a false choice, just as it's another false choice to say we should put the emphasis on personal responsibility or social responsibility. It seems to me the two go together. And that we do want a society that encourages people to take personal responsibility and, in these terms, worries about individual sin. But you need to create the structures in society that make it more likely that people will live by those higher standards and be in a position to take personal responsibility. That's why I ended with the "It's a Wonderful Life" story, because if you look at that movie, it really is showing you that the social system you create can create a society in which better or worse values predominate. And I think we need to bring those two together. I think on the part of a lot of individuals who put more emphasis on individual sin, I think it's a sincere position, and I would have a sort of partial argument with them about that. But I also think it can be in politics a manipulative position that is designed to push us away from the many parts of the scripture, Amos, Isaiah, Micah, Jesus himself, that point us toward social justice, or in the old terms of social gospel Protestantism, building the kingdom.
You answered the question about Mitt Romney. Here's a similar question. Was there a religious impact in the 2000 presidential election when Gore chose Lieberman as a running mate?
That is an issue that I have always never seen good enough data on. I mean, I thought it was a great thing that Al Gore did that, because I thought it was great to begin to break down barriers to Jews at the top of our politics. And I have my disagreements with Senator Lieberman these days, although he has said a lot of very interesting things, and this is a part of Lieberman I personally like about sort of religion's connection to politics, and aren't all that different from what Gore has said. So I think Gore did break a barrier there, and I thought that was very important. Just parenthetically, I think it's very interesting if you want to see how politics has changed between 1960 and 2000. When John Kennedy ran for president, to win votes from Protestants, and particularly evangelical Protestants, he had to say that his religion would have nothing to do with how he governed. When Joe Lieberman ran in 2000, he was seen as trying to win votes from evangelicals by saying how important his religion was to him. You know, back then, the problem was that you weren't Protestant. In 2000, the problem for Democrats was that they weren't religious enough. Now, I think Joe Lieberman was actually more religious than John Kennedy from all the evidence. So I think there was authenticity on the part of both of them. But I think it's just an intriguing shift in those 40 years.
This question is, why is the Supreme Court tilting so Catholic?
You know, that's an interesting question. First of all, it's not exactly liberal Catholic. It's a very particular kind of Catholic. There is a very good piece, I think it was in the New Republic, but it could have been elsewhere, talking about how Catholics had, through their tradition, more fully developed theories on the relationship between the law and the public and the private. And so they ended up reflecting many of the ideas that religious Protestants might have at this moment, but had a theoretical foundation. But that may well be way too complicated, and it just happens that the most the judges who are easiest to confirm for conservative presidents happen to be Catholic, and it could be as simple as that.
I am a longtime liberal Democrat. I'm reading this, by the way. I'm far less frightened by the so-called religious right than I am by the hyper-individualist libertarian techno-utopians that are increasingly dominating the political discourse and economic enterprise. Could you comment?
Would you mind, is it against the rules? Could the person who asked that raise your hand? You don't have to. I love that question. Thank you. Yeah, that's how I feel. I mean, I'm not sure I would choose such elevated or interesting words as you chose in that. But I do think that there is, I think radical individualism is actually the enemy of true individualism, because the individuals are developed and nurtured within communities, and that it's much harder to be an autonomous, a kind of free individual absent some support, personal, social, occasionally financial, from the larger community. And that I think they're one of the reasons religion became bigger in our politics is because people of very different ideological persuasions had this yearning for a sense of community and rejected a kind of hyper-individualism. I believe in a genuine individualism and certainly an individual liberty, but I think that this hyper-individualism is something that a lot of Americans kind of pull away from. And so I appreciate the question. Thank you.
Your comments on the new seven sins.
I would have to think of all seven right here on the spot.
Well,
somebody want to offer me a list? I don't think I'm quick enough to think of the new seven sins.
Does
somebody have the seven in mind? Oh, I see. The social. I suppose the ones that that I talk about in the book a lot are indifference to poverty, mistreating the environment, sort of a sense of various forms of prejudice, family values not properly understood. I mean, I let me just end with that. I can think of some other sins that we could go on, but I want to make a point on that, which is, I really do believe in family values, do believe that on balance, the two-parent family is the better way to raise kids. The social science evidence is there. Now, it doesn't mean everybody can do it. It doesn't mean single mothers do a bad job. There are great single mothers who struggle heroically to this. On balance, the intact family is a good thing. I ask people, what does gay marriage have to do with that? The responsibility for holding the family together in large part falls on heterosexuals, and that we heterosexuals often are doing a good enough job of wrecking the family by ourselves. Why should we blame our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters? And so I want a discourse about family values, but I don't want it to be a discourse rooted in a kind of prejudice.
We unfortunately are butting up against the clock, and so we have time for one more question. And I don't know that I picked wisely, but this was an interesting question. I was recently in Iran for a philosophy conference. I had a wonderful discussion with a philosopher cleric who was seriously arguing that indeed America was a manifestation of evil in the world. We agreed about many things. He spoke in theological terms, and I in more Western leftist philosophical terms. Do you think metaphysically that good and evil are manifested in politics?
Wow. Only at the
and
Commonwealth Club.
And you got 30 Club, seconds to answer.
Only
that
at the Commonwealth Club would somebody have had that experience and ask such a question. Can I answer yes or no? briefly, read me the last piece of it, just so I can.
Are good and evil, metaphysically, good and evil manifested in politics?
Yes. I think the answer is yes. I think there can be good and evil in politics, but there are also a lot of grays in politics. And I think the struggle is to figure out when you are dealing with genuine good and evil. A Nazi on the ballot might be an easy one to deal with, or someone who proposes discrimination against some minority or who is absolutely indifferent to the suffering of others, including the poor. But many of these are not. In my book, and I'll close on this, I quote Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who is the chief rabbi of Great Britain. He wrote a wonderful book called To Heal a Fractured World. And Sacks makes the point that we've got to be very careful in relating religion to politics, because for many people in religious faiths, compromise is often an immoral thing to do, that one must remain faithful to a particular doctrine, a particular set of ideas. In democratic politics, compromise is often absolutely essential to getting something done. Oddly, in one sphere, compromise is immoral. In the other sphere, compromise is profoundly moral. And I think what we have to do is to find a way to be informed by our traditions, lifted up by our traditions, held to high standards by our traditions, and then within the public square be able to sit down with our fellow citizens and use those moral insights in a way that improves the common weal for all, including those who may not share our religious faith. And I want to thank you all very, very much for coming tonight.
E.J. Dionne, syndicated columnist from The Washington Post and author of the new book, Sold Out, Reclaiming Faith and Politics After the Religious Right. Dionne, who is also a regular commentator on NPR, spoke on March 13th to the Commonwealth Club of California. If you missed part of this hour's program with E.J. Dionne, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. When you go there, you can hear this week's show, subscribe to our free weekly podcast, and join a discussion about the ideas you heard in this and previous programs. You can also search our archives and listen to speakers such as CNN correspondent Christiane Amanpour, Father Gregory Boyle, founder of the Homeboys program in Los Angeles, and author of The End of Faith, Sam Harris. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penn-Cava.
Word for Word is produced by Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.